want to introduce myself. I'm Hans Spalteholz, and teach religion and literature at a Concordia College in Portland, Oregon. And we're venturing into a series, although they are self-contained units, really. Isn't necessary that one attends all of the sessions. But we're launching a series on fiction. And we're going from, in terms of text, from a very simple text, in a sense, a very short one at least, a short story by Alan Paton called Haypenny, which we'll take a look at today in a little while. And then with a couple of days intervening, we want to look at an interesting novel by Olaf Hartmann on Thursday. It's called Holy Masquerade. Have any of you read it or heard of it? Ah, okay. Well, it's quite a story about a pastor's wife who writes a diary on her husband, and he's the pastor. And it packs a powerful impact, I think. At least it did on me and everyone. Would you agree?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. And it really is worth discussing.
Is that the sale here?
Mm-hmm. I think it is. Yes. Uh-huh. So if you have a chance, you might want to take a look at it and read it. And if you want a reading note, aside from all of the personal involvement that one feels as one reads the book, an interesting question to ask, since in our Lutheran tradition the terms law gospel are so big for us, sort of like the key to our communicating the gospel to one another, might be interesting to ask how law and gospel happen, if they happen at all in that story. At any rate, that's just a suggestion if you want to work ahead a bit. And then the last day, let's see, we're on Thursday now, Friday, I hope to devote the period to a rather ambitious project, namely a Dostoevsky novel, Crime and Punishment. Now, if you know Crime and Punishment, you'll say how arrogant or stupid, I don't know which, to try to do that novel in one time slot. So I think I want to say candidly right from the start that we obviously are not going to do the whole novel on the one hand. On the other hand, I think I want to say maybe we should plan right from the start to spend about an hour and a half on it, to start at 4 and go, say, to 5:30 and just plan on second setting for supper. Maybe we'll take a stretch in the middle so we don't get too weary sitting for one time. So at any rate, that's the general procedure or a general plan for this week. We're doing something else on Wednesday, but that is in a sense independent of this series. That is, it's an all-day seminar on the problem of suffering and evil in relation to certain texts and in relation to our own experience. It's going to be a more personal kind of thing. It'll be a seminar, and that's why we're designing it for 18. Now, if a great number of people sign up, we might do it twice. Though I'm not sure if I'm capable of going through something like that twice. Well, how to read fiction. I noticed up on the bulletin board, the way it was put up was as follows, how to read, in quotes, fiction. And that wasn't my editorializing, that was just someone else's idea. And I thought that was rather interesting. It's like, do you read me, man? Can you decode me? How do you read fiction? How do you decode it? How do you cut through the secret message underneath? That's not my goal. And I partly take my clue from a writer like Joseph Conrad, who in one of his stories, Heart of Darkness, which I understand is coming out in a movie ere long, yeah, should be extremely interesting. He has a little comment, very offhanded comment, by the narrator, something to the effect that most people tell a story and they think of it something like a hazelnut. Namely, what you have to do is just crack that shell and then you've got the whole kernel on the inside. But Conrad describes himself as a character who writes a story which is such that the whole story begins to glow from the inside out. And there is no shell and easy kernel where you can crack and just get through to it. We're not going to ask how do we decode fiction, but rather something else. How do we let fiction be so that we can hear it and maybe learn to hear better in general? Why literature? Let me begin with a few suggestions that people have come up with in the past, why we read literature, which may exclude a lot of people. And I would like to think literature is for everyone. Serious literature is for everyone. But it tends to exclude people if we do this kind of a thing on literature. For instance, for some people, literature is principally escape. It's for escape. And now if you have time for that kind of thing, like some people have time for the soap operas and the afternoons, the housewives with nothing to do, well, that's fine. But I'm a serious man, a busy man. I can't waste my time reading literature. Or perhaps what I do is I read mysteries. By the way, I understand this is very good therapy. Before I go to bed at night, murder mysteries to turn everything off. My understanding of literature is escape. Okay, that has its role, and I know a number of people who delight in their closing their evening by reading murder mysteries and get to the point where they've read so many, it's a challenge whether they can guess the ending ahead of the author's tipping his hand finally. Other people say, you know, life is serious business, and if you're going to read literature, especially if you're going to teach it to our kids at school, we want it to be edifying, to have a moral, to have a purpose. Its aim and object is to inculcate morality. And if it doesn't do that, I'm not so sure that we should expose our children to it. Think of the language in some of the literature that's taught in our schools. I think we should have a check on our local library. Maybe some of the books should be removed, like Catcher in the Rye by Salinger, or you name it. And so the view of literature as teaching a lesson, again, probably will eliminate a lot of readers and a lot of literature. Like how about the Bible? That has all sorts of things that I don't know I'd want to expose my children to. So a third approach to literature has been, well, let's just let it be art for art's sake. After all, a literature is a thing of beauty, and a thing of beauty is a joy forever. And we must learn to appreciate the arts. Maybe the more difficult literature will take us a bit more time. But if it has any value at all, it's got to be a thing of beauty. I think art for art's sake points to an important dimension of literature, namely that there is a beauty of language in language and in structuring it, but that too can tend to be elitist and really eliminate a lot of people. I'd like to say, I think, that literature is for everybody, for every man, and that we can hardly afford not to spend some time with literature for two reasons. I think for delight and also for insight. Those two words kind of go together, delight and insight. I have a little quote here, see if I can find it, from Robert Frost, whose vision of poetry is that it begins in delight and ends in wisdom. The curve of poetry moves from delight to wisdom. I like that. Another way to pick up what literature does is to imagine a kind of a triangle. And if the piece of literature is the triangle itself, this is an idea that comes from Meyer Abrams in his little book, The Mirror and the Lamp, then it has a multiplicity of relations to life. If the work of literature is like a triangle, in one way it points to everything that's going on out there in life. It's like a mirror. Shakespeare once said in one of his plays, Hamlet, that the actor should hold the mirror up to nature. And it helps us, as a mirror does, it helps us catch a certain moment or a certain passion. It helps us catch a certain slice of life. Or as one writer puts it, this is Dorothy Van Gant, she says, literature reveals the direction of men's lives. All of these are ways in which literature mirrors lives. Sometimes it distorts a bit, like Flannery O'Connor, this Catholic lady who died of a very difficult, painful nerve disease, but wrote some magnificent stories, short stories, Everything That Rises Must Converge. And she caricatures her people, and in the process, all sorts of interesting things come up. Some of them are crippled, they all are a little bit odd and offbeat. They do strange things, like a man tattoos, finally, a picture of Jesus Christ across his back, because it's the one place on his body that he doesn't have room for any other tattoo, and it's a big Byzantine Christ. And he wants to say something to his wife. Now that's strange and weird, and it's not a realistic picture of life at all, but it really opens our eyes, it makes us see new things. Sometimes literature, when it mirrors life, idealizes life. Sometimes it interprets it in strange ways or in pleasing ways. Well, take this triangle in another direction down here. Let's put it over on this side for you. Here's the author. And then let's think of literature as an expression. Is it poetry, for instance, is often the expression of the artist's view of life, or maybe a certain unforgettable moment, an emotion. And then the interest of the relation of literature to life is not so much that it mirrors life, but that it expresses someone's feelings, inmost thoughts. Sometimes literature is secretly confession. I understand that Goethe, who had a lot of trouble with his life, in a way his life has been interpreted as a kind of catharsis of a number of different love relationships, for example. Interpreted it from that point of view, his literature is, in a sense, extremely biographical. Much modern literature, in fact, is a covert, hidden, sometimes not very, even very well hidden biography. Kafka, for example, his literature has been interpreted as one long, agonizing cry of his innermost being. Here's our little triangle, the relationship of literature to life. Mirroring life, expressing the artist. Another direction down here is the audience. Literature as a design on the audience. Literature designed to communicate, whatever, to communicate ideas, maybe to propagandize, maybe to convert. In any case, literature aiming to go somewhere. Some people say, unless literature does that, unless it's preaching, unless it's somehow bettering our society, I don't know if we should spend time on it. And some people want to cut off these connections and say, remember that craftsmanship, literature as fiction, not as something made up, but as something made, constructed. Poesis, poetic as making. Look at that craftsmanship. Man, did this guy make his birdhouse nice. I love it. And perhaps literature is all of this, but let me suggest still another notion which isn't even encompassed in that diagram, and that is literature as hypothetical experience. Let's pretend, given these and these and these circumstances, a great king who's aged, who's about to feel it's time somehow to resign, and yet kings can't resign, decides to give away his kingdom to his three daughters. I wonder what that would be like if a king would do that. Let's try it out. And we've got a King Lear in the making. And now let's see what happens when that, given that beginning, and King Lear being the kind of king he is. Hypothetical experience. in which we learn something, perhaps, delight in something, perhaps, see something in a new way. Okay, a little bit of introduction then on why people read literature and what are some of the many things that happens. And you know, everyone goes at a piece of literature differently. Some look at it for that mirror, others for what it says to them by way of an insight into the artist, others what it teaches, others just for the beauty of the thing. And I want to share this with you because I think so often when we're reading literature and someone comes in who is an expert, the idea is, hush, the sage is here, now wisdom floweth forth from him. My object is just about to do the opposite, to put you, if you're not experienced in literature, into possession of the kind of things that are involved in literature so you can be independent readers better. And so you, if you already are independent readers, and some people say to you, how did you get that out of that story? Or you're reading it into the story, that you can say, oh, well, look it. Here's some things to look at. So one of my goals is to encourage reading and then to encourage independence and courage in reading. Now, a next step is a little diagram I've worked up here on the board. Not all stories do the same kind of thing. And short stories, and we're going to look at one shortly, consist usually of a certain number of elements. These elements are plot, the sequence of events, character, the agents who are in the story. Sometimes they're human beings, sometimes they're spirits, sometimes they're animals, sometimes it's nature is even an agent. A storm kicks up a storm and goes after someone on the shore. Racine's Phaedra. Setting is the time and the place where it happens. Sometimes setting is just backdrop. Sometimes the setting is nothing, like in a Japanese painting, where the Japanese have no compulsion, or the Chinese, to fill it all in like we Westerners do. And they just leave canvas there and maybe put up one beautiful bamboo sprig that bends but doesn't break. Setting, emotion, that's supposed to be emotion, the feeling. These are sort of parts. Emotion is sort of the whole, the atmosphere, the quality. And then idea. Very often there's some kind of an idea or maybe a tension of ideas in a story. Now that's usually all there. Now here's the new thing. The new thing is to suggest that a story is not just a story, but it's going someplace. It has a direction, a goal, an end, a purpose. It's not just an internal design, but a design on us. And then, if we can roughly say that all stories might be, just for a working hypothesis to get into some differences in stories, be either a plot story, or a character story, or a setting story, or an emotion story, or an idea story, then the other elements, including elements of the plot, are all means toward that end. Let me suggest, for example, in a plot story, we want to know, well, how's it going to turn out? Adventure stories are plot stories. Treasure Island, we get caught up in the adventure, and it's a delight in going along the way. Murder mysteries, detective stories, tend to be plot stories. Whodunit? And we've got to be able to count on that the butler is a certain kind of person, and so on. So the characters are stock figures. Now sometimes the writers surprise us, but they depend upon those conventions. On the other hand, sometimes stories are character stories. The illustration I like to use here is a Reader's Digest series, the most unforgettable character I've ever met. Plot is not a big thing there, usually. Often it's a sequence of events. My grandma, I remember this and this about her, and then there's a story of so-and-so, and then Grandpa once told us what she did on this and this occasion. Generally, setting tends to be background. There are, however, a group of American writers, the so-called local colorists, whose whole purpose was, in the middle of the 19th century, to catch the flavor of what life was like in the tremendously shifting, developing scene in America in a certain region. like Bret Hart, the luck of Roaring Camp, right? He knew that in other parts of the United States, nobody knew what was going on out in the West, and he had to capture the West. Or, who were some of the other local colorists? Bret Hart, I mentioned. Who wrote the Uncle Remus tales?
Joel Chandler
Harris? Is it Joel Chandler Harris? Okay. George Washington Cable wrote the old Creole stories down in the South in Louisiana. Sarah Orne Jewett wrote stories of New England. Mark Twain had his local color stories. Now, that was before there was a lot of wide publication, before TV. These people knew there was something unique about their area, right? And that was their goal, their purpose. Emotion, the best illustration I can think of here are some of the horror stories that, say, Edgar Allan Poe writes, right? The Fall of the House of Usher, The Telltale Heart is a classic, The Pit and the Pendulum. Right? The whole purpose is to make us experience a certain feeling of horror. And then idea stories, well, what do we say there? Candide is a good example of a person who writes idea stories. All right. A Candide. Somebody want to help me out?
Voltaire,
right, writes Candide, writes a story to make a point. What about Ayn Rand? Okay, stories written to make a point. Example, maybe some very simple ones. The fables, Aesop's fables, right? Those stories are all obviously designed to make a point. What about in the New Testament?
Parables.
Parables, right? Aren't they designed to make a point? What a failure they'd be if we're looking at them simply for an exciting plot story. Although sometimes the plots are very important. Okay, maybe one or two more things and then we'll shift gears. Another thing that I find very important is to think about what's going on at the beginning of the story. Beginning, what's the situation at the end? And what's happened from getting from the beginning through the middle to the end? That's Aristotle's Poetics, right? Oh, especially interesting, is there a change in anybody? That's important to look for, and one of the most important clues. And finally, two more things. The next item is what I call point of view. Those of you who've done some studying in literature are probably familiar with this term. Point of view is not the opinion that the author have, but it's the angle of narration. Now, there are a number of points of view. One common point of view is called omniscient. The author is sitting up here, sort of in a catbird seat, and just telling you what's going on in all the people's minds when he wants to. For instance, he can be in this room and he's telling us how the heroine is lamenting a certain thing, and then he just shifts over to this room and what is going on in the mind of her antagonist. Right? And meanwhile, back on the farm, and so with great freedom, he moves from one place to the other. Omniscient point of view, he can look into everyone's mind. What a privilege! You know, I don't know anyone else's mind except my own. And then I don't even know. And here this writer tells us what's going on in all these people's minds. Fascinating. And if he does it well, he tells us we know more about Hamlet, some of us, than we know about our own father. So literature is a tremendous adventure into people's lives. And particularly the omniscient point of view explores and exploits and capitalizes on that idea. Now, another does just the opposite. It's the dramatic point of view. It pretends as if the writer is like an audience watching a play. In other words, the only thing he dares to know is what he sees happening, what people do and do to one another, what people say, body language, and that's about it. It's like seeing a play, hence they call it the dramatic point of view. Ernest Hemingway likes to tell stories that way. Faulkner does a combination of things. he likes to use the next one that I'll mention, third person restricted. He will look into the mind of one person and tells it third person, so he can talk about that person, he can describe him, but he goes into him, but he restricts himself to that one person, and so all we know about other people is what the other people tell him. Now that Henry James is the master of that device. Those of you who study James probably know that. It's very, very difficult reading. Also very challenging, and very nice because we can focus in on one individual. Now, focusing on one individual classically has gone a different way, and that's the first person. All the others have been third-person narration. First person, the person says, I. Like David Copperfield is a classic, right? He tells his story. It's like pretending it's autobiography. And the great thing about that is it immediately makes it believable. Well, obviously it happened if he told it. The classic for that is Robinson Crusoe. Have any of you read Robinson Crusoe? Right? It's a story about a man who takes a trip and he gets dumped on an island and it's all first person. Well, that never happened. But he gives us the exact date that he leaves London and he quit his job. And you know, it's so true to life, it has so much verisimilitude, as they call it, that you really have to be shocked into awareness that that's all made up. So, first person point of view, it's important for us to think, oh yes, that's the narrator's point of view and not necessarily the author. He's not necessarily giving a biography. After all, it's fiction. And yet, the author can use any amount of personal biography he wants to, so it's sometimes very tricky to sort the one out from the other. Now, that would be the main character telling the story. Sometimes first person is a minor character, and that's the advantage, that he can watch the main character. Sometimes it's a marginal character, like, let's see if I can think of it, the one, Wuthering Heights, Emily Bronte, I think, or is it the other Bronte, Charlotte? It's Emily, right? Now there's a visitor who lets us know what's going on amidst this strange household, and then later on he has to get some information from another character who was there when he's gone. So the authors sometimes do some very awkward things to stay truthful to their point of view. Well, all of this is in a sense technical matter, and I hope you'll forgive me, but I think it's valuable material to keep in mind when you're going to be looking at some stories. It all seems very natural the moment we get into it, as a rule. One last thing I'd like to talk about is values. No story is just a neutral story. No story is just a neutral story, but there's always a core of values or norms with which the writer is functioning. Now, how do you detect those values? That's really tricky. Usually we don't even think about it, unless one person obviously espouses or speaks for the author's values. Now, George Bernard Shaw is a classic. You know right away when you're seeing a George Bernard Shaw play what his values are. It comes out quite clearly. But many writers really don't lay it out like that at all. And I find that in certain fiction, the way the values come in is in how the author makes us feel about somebody. Like we say, ooh, I just hated so-and-so. How could that author create someone as ugly as that? Well, maybe that was what he wants us to feel. And if we do an examination of what effect he had on us, that may give us a clue that he espouses a certain value. But we have to infer that from the story. Now, I want to stop here because that's all of the introductory material that I wanted to give, and I'd like to shift gears to Alan Payton and the story Haypenny, of which I have copies and I'm going to hand out to you. Anyone want to comment about any of this more introductory material? You've been very patient. While I pass these out, I want to say just a word about Alan Payton. He was born in 1903. He was the head of a reformatory in South Africa for delinquents for about 12 years. Then he got into writing, and wrote Cry the Beloved Country, which immediately catapulted him into fame. A very, very touching story about how a young man goes downhill because he goes to the big city, and his father, a pastor from out in the country where everything is stable and orderly, tries to come to the city to rescue his boy, and the anguish that that father feels in that experience. Another story that Peyton wrote is Too Late the Phalarope. It's a great tragic novel about a fine police sergeant who becomes attracted to a black girl, and that is violating the iron law in South Africa. And it tells the story of what happens to him. And then he wrote a series of short stories called Tales from a Troubled Land. And this story is taken from that. I thought what we would do is, it's not a long story, is we'd let you read it. I think there are enough of you so that you can look at it two on two and read the story together. We'll just have a time of quiet now. Read the story. And then I'd like to suggest some things that we might discuss about it. Okay? How does that sound? Maybe you want to take, let's see, I'll send them this way and this way. Take one, if you can share, one-on-one, let's see if we can get them around so that everyone has an opportunity to read. One other possible way would be to read it out loud, but I think that's disturbing. Most people read much more quickly with their eyes. There are not too many. I brought along 25 from Portland, so I assure you there are not enough here. Does anyone have an idea? Would it be better to read it out loud?
I think so.
Yeah. Sure.
Shall we try that? Of the 600 boys at the reformatory, about 100 were from 10 to 14 years of age. My department had from time to time expressed the intention of taking them away and of establishing a special institution for them, more like an industrial school than a reformatory. This would have been a good thing, for their offenses were very trivial, and they would have been better by themselves. Had such a school been established, I would have liked to have been principal of it myself, for it would have been an easier job. Small boys turn instinctively towards affection, and one controls them by it naturally and easily. Some of them, if I came near them, either on parade or in school or at football, would observe me watchfully, not directly or fully, but obliquely and secretly. Sometimes I would surprise them at it, in some small sign of recognition, which would satisfy them so that they would cease to observe me and would give their full attention to the event of the moment. But I knew that my authority was thus confirmed and strengthened. These secret relations with them were a source of continuous pleasure to me. Had they been my own children, I would no doubt have given a greater expression to it. But often I would move through the silent and orderly parade and stand by one of them. He would look straight ahead in front of him with a little frown of concentration that expressed both childish awareness of and manly indifference to my nearness. Sometimes I would tweak his ear, and he would give me a brief smile of acknowledgement, or frown with still greater concentration. It was natural, I suppose, to confine these outward expressions to the very smallest, but they were taken as symbolic, and some older boys would observe them and take themselves to be included. It was a relief when the reformatory was passing through times of turbulence and trouble, and when there was danger of estrangement between authority and boys, to make these simple and natural gestures, which were reassurances both to me and them that nothing important had changed. On Sunday afternoons, when I was on duty, I would take my car to the reformatory and watch the free boys being signed out at the gate. This simple operation was also watched by many boys not free, who would tell each other, "In so many weeks, I'll be signed out myself." Amongst the watchers were always some of the small boys, and these I would take by turns in the car. We would go out to the Potchefstroom Road with its ceaseless streams of traffic, and to the Bar Gwanath Crossroads, and come back to the Van Wickris Road to the reformatory. I would talk to them about their families, their parents, their sisters and brothers, and I would pretend to know nothing of Durban, Port Elizabeth, Apachefstrun, I'm not sure about this, Klokolan, and asked them if these places were bigger than Johannesburg. One of the small boys was Haypenny. He was about 12 years old. He came from Bloemfontein and was the biggest talker of them all. His mother worked in a white person's house, and he had two brothers and two sisters. His brothers were Richard and Dickie, and his sisters were Anna and Mina. "Richard and Dickie?" I asked. "Yes, Mynheer." In English, I said, "Richard and Dickie are the same name." "Are the same name." When we returned to the reformatory, I sent for Haypenny's papers. There it was plainly set down. Haypenny was away, with no relatives at all. He had been taken in from one home to another, but he was naughty and uncontrollable, and eventually had taken to pilfering at the market. I then sent for the letter book and found that Haypenny wrote regularly, or rather that others wrote for him till he could write himself, to Mrs. Betty Marmon of 48 Block Street, Bloemfontein. But Mrs. Marmon had never once replied to him. When questioned, he had said, "Perhaps she is sick." I sat down and wrote at once to the social welfare officer at Bloemfontein, asking him to investigate. The next time I had Haypenny out in the car, I questioned him again about his family, and he told me the same as before: his mother, Richard and Dickie, Anna and Mina. But he softened the D in Dickie so that it sounded like Dickie. "I thought you said Dickie," I said. "I said Ticky," he said. He watched me with concealed apprehension, and I came to the conclusion that this waif of Bloemfontein was a clever boy who had told me a story that was all imagination and had changed one single letter of it to make it safe from any question. And I thought I understood it all too, that he was fatherless and motherless, and that no one in the world cared whether he was alive or dead. This gave me a strong feeling for him, and I went out of my way to manifest toward him the fatherly care that was the state. That the state, though not in those words, had enjoined upon me by giving me this job. Then the letter came from the social welfare officer in Bloemfontein saying that Mrs. Betty Marmon of 48 Block Street was a real person, and that she had four children, Richard and Dickie, Anna and Mina, but that Haypenny was no child of hers, and she knew him only as a derelict of the streets. She had never answered his letters, because he wrote to her as mother, and she was no mother of his, nor did she wish to play any such role. She was a decent woman, a faithful member of the church, and she had no thought of corrupting her family by letting them have anything to do with such a child. But Haypenny seemed to me anything but the usual delinquent. His desire to have a family was so strong, and his reformatory record was so blameless, that his anxiety to please and obey so great, that I began to feel a great duty toward him. Therefore, I asked him about his mother. He could not speak enough of her, nor with too high praise. She was loving, honest, and strict. Her home was clean. She had affection for all her children. It was clear that the homeless child, even as he had attached himself to me, would have attached himself to her. He had observed her, even as he had observed me, but did not know the secret of how to open her heart so that she would take him in and save him from the lonely life that he led. "Why did you steal when you had such a mother?" I asked. He could not answer that. Not all his brains nor his courage could find an answer to such a question, for he knew that with such a mother, he would not have stolen at all. "The boy's name is Dickie," I said, "not Ticky." And then he knew the deception was revealed. Another boy might have said, "I told you it was Dickie," but he was too intelligent for that. He knew that if I had established that the boy's name was Dickie, I must have established other things too. I was shocked by the immediate and visible effect of my action. His whole brave assurance died within him, and he stood there exposed, not a liar, but as a homeless child who had surrounded himself with mother, brothers, and sisters, who did not exist. I had shattered the very foundation of his pride and his sense of human significance. He fell sick at once, and the doctor said it was tuberculosis. I wrote at once to Mrs. Marmon, telling her the whole story and of how this small boy had observed her and had decided that she was the person he desired for his mother. But she wrote back saying that she could take no responsibility for him. For one thing, Haypenny was a Mosuto, and she was a colored woman. And for another, she had never had a child in trouble, and how could she take such a boy? Tuberculosis is a strange thing. Sometimes it manifests itself suddenly in the most unlikely host, and swiftly sweeps to the end. Haypenny withdrew himself from the world, from all principals and mothers, and the doctor said there was little hope. In desperation, I sent money for Mrs. Marmon to come. She was a decent, homely woman, and seeing that the situation was serious, she, without fuss or embarrassment, adopted Haypenny for her own. The whole reformatory accepted her as his mother, and she sat the whole day with him, talked to him of Richard and Dickie, Anna and Mina, and how they were all waiting for him to come home. She poured out her affection on him and had no fear of his sickness, nor did she allow it to prevent her from satisfying his hunger to be owned. She talked to him of what they would do when he came back, and how he would go to school, and what they would buy for Guy Fawkes Night. He, in his turn, gave whole attention to her, and when I visited him, he was grateful, but I had passed out of his existence. I felt judged in that I had sensed only the existence and not the measure of his desire. I wished I had done something sooner, more wise, more prodigal. We buried him on the reformatory farm, and Mrs. Marmon said to me, "When you put up the cross, put he was my son." "I'm ashamed," she said, "that I wouldn't take him." "The sickness," I said, "the sickness would have come." "No," she said, shaking her head with certainty, "it wouldn't have come. And if it had come at home, it would have been different." So she left for Bloemfontein after a strange visit to a reformatory. And I was left, too, with the resolve to be more prodigal in the task that the state, though not in so many words, had enjoined on me. I'd like now to do something different than we normally do in these kind of forums. I'd like you to break up into some small groups. And I have a couple of questions that I'd like you to discuss, though you can discuss anyway. And then after maybe 15 minutes, see how our time is doing, maybe not. I'd like to do this. Let's see, do I have your permission to go beyond five? See, I think it's so important. There are two ways to do this. One, for me to say, look, here's what I see in the story, and what do you think of what I see in the story? But I'd really like you to talk about it. And there are a lot of you who have things to say, but you're not going to say them because someone else is going to pull the trigger faster. Let's spend a little time, all right, in small group, and think about maybe these two things. What character do you find yourself identifying with? That's one thing. And secondly, what changes do you see happening in people? And the third thing is, whom do we tend to judge as having been inadequate in his response? Or who do we feel could have done better? Who could have done better? And finally, any insights you come up with? Okay, identification, who we identify with. I'll put it on the board maybe, okay? Change we discern. Who could have done better? And insight. Okay, why don't you just go into five. And I know you're probably anxious to hear what others said. So can we go back to plenary? You are, of course, welcome to continue the discussion later on your own, but... which question was most fruitful for you? Someone want to speak from some group?
Well, maybe that one on whether we should, how we should judge them, or if we should judge them in terms of what they, could they have done better
in
the situation?
Yeah.
Who could have done better?
We just simply said
we all find ourselves in the dilemma of circumstances, and it's so difficult to be judgmental without being sympathetic to where they were at that particular moment that they found themselves in. And who of us would have done maybe differently?
Do you think the author wants us to be, wants us to make judgments?
I don't think so. I think he wants us to be understanding.
To be sympathetic?
To be sympathetic.
To whom?
To both the narrator and to the mother in the story, whatever her name was. And mm-hmm. to Halfpenny, too, of course, all three of them.
Mm-hmm. Is it like a parable?
Okay, do you think it's like a parable that the main point of the story is to convey some an insight or an idea? What would the idea be?
Protecting someone's pride.
Protecting someone's pride.
Going a little further to help someone. Think of the mother. If she might have made some move, it might have helped.
In other words, we really think that the mother should have been more ready to accept him.
Well, it's like learning the hard way, you know, by telling the story, then maybe you won't have to learn the hard way.
Okay, you're getting a lesson you get out of it, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay. What about this business of judgment? I want to come back to that. Walt, you nodded. Yes, you felt it was designed to evoke judgment in us. You want to comment on that a little further?
Well, I guess I just think that Peyton writes in order for us to feel some of the pathos and pain involved in black and colored existence in South Africa, and the way in which that, I fully understand why that woman didn't want to have anything. And I fully understand why the boy wanted to have a family. And one of the things I think I'm asking more and more after I read this story is that there's a character that could have done better that isn't mentioned. Mm-hmm. Or at least is mentioned maybe only obliquely.
Who is that?
The state.
Aha. Is that the villain?
Yeah.
Who falls under harsher judgment in your mind, the mother or the reformed school principal? That's always been my feeling too.
Well, I think the mother, but only because the narrator is judgmental of himself. But I think if you look at the story, the mother is the most harshly judged.
I think I agree with that too, that the mother seems to be judged more harshly because you keep hearing from the narrator the efforts that he's making. They're small, but they're gentle, and they're towards the child, and they're supportive. And what you hear of the mother outside of the child's description is that she was a good church member. And that's about it.
Well, what else?
She goes on to produce, though. She comes through.
Yeah.
She comes through.
That's right.
Push comes to shove. She really moves out.
Doesn't the author, in a way, give us some pretty good evidence which at least help us understand the mother?
She's got four of her own children. I don't think she really knew the situation. He writes to her. You don't know what he writes to her.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think she's aware of it.
Right. Okay. No father. Interesting observation. One other little question. To move quickly, what do you make of this statement at the end? Mrs. Marmon says, when you put up the cross, put he was my son. Do you think she's trying to absolve herself?
Not absolve herself, but do something to make her
feel. Make herself feel good?
Ease her conscience.
What about the narrator? The sickness would have come. Why does he say that, do you think, to the mother?
Well, he's protecting her pride there, or her. He's making it easier for her.
Yeah,
but isn't he
get rid of, he tried to get rid of his own guilt feeling?
She had a feeling of guilt, I think, and he was trying to be.
He was trying to make some kind of an effort to say, well, it's not your fault that the boy got sick. The sickness would have come. The fact that he repeats the word sickness tells me that he's groping for saying something. You know, I look at her less harshly in that line. I think that's a magnificent line that she says, when you put up the cross, put he was my son. Wow, that's something. She's adopting him as her son. Yeah. But is she sure? Is she sure that he's going to die?
No.
When she says, when she tells him, when you come home?
Yeah.
No, I think she's playing that straight, isn't she? Do you think she would have adopted him?
Yeah. She's completing her act by putting her name on this. After all, if this is if she's a colored woman and this is a black child, she is identifying herself with him.
She's committing herself. You know, she said no one in her family had ever been in trouble, none of her kids had ever
been. Right. Have any of you ever taken in an ex-con under your wing to sort of supervise him for his re-entry into society? That's kind of scary. I think I'd be afraid to do it.
Back in prison. Mine cost us $2,000.
Yeah, see?
We had a neighbor who did that, our neighboring pastor in a small congregation in Wisconsin, and it drove him out of town because the young fellow stole the town blank.
Look at that. Mrs. Marmon was taking quite a risk.
Well, in South Africa, even worse.
Yes.
Because colored are a notch above, have some rights and privileges that black do not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think too, knowing that she was colored, and that in the end that Tiffany was black, says that she's really lowering herself in order to make that statement.
Yeah.
Excuse me, but what's the difference between colored and black?
Is Paul Wee still here? He had to leave. I think in South Africa they have about three major groupings, white, black, colored, and Bantu. Where are they socially? Are they a notch above the blacks? And Mosuto must be a black tribe. Right. Is this play in any way relevant to Christians? Is it just an interesting story and we say, well, we learned a lesson from it? Or does it have a cutting edge into our Christian faith and life?
Yeah, my brother's keeper, huh?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of the situations you find yourself in, the tendency to avoid the critical decision that you must make, and the need to make those decisions, and the risk, and the giving of oneself on behalf of someone else. I think all the guilt, the trying to absolve the guilt by superficially, all these things come into play.
What about comparing Halfpenny to the book people? There was a very moving item in a column about a shipload of boat people that saw an American battleship in the South China Sea. And so they put up this big sign that says, "We chose freedom, help us." And they pulled up, and the officers called the captain, and he came and looked, and he said, "Let's move away." And then the officers went down and ate their roast beef and potatoes.
There are perhaps other analogies to the immediate care. I want to look back at the narrator once more. Maybe one last thing about the narrator. I think he's very harsh on himself. I don't think it's necessarily Peyton saying he did a terrible thing like this, though in fact maybe he did. But isn't the person who learns the most the narrator? And I think when he says when he makes a resolve, I believe he wants us to take that as not just fancy words, but a genuine resolve. And the one word that gives it away is the word prodigal. Right? He doesn't just want to follow the rules that are laid down on him by the state, because the state doesn't lay down rules like that. He wants to be more prodigal. That is to say, excessive in his what? Lavishing care. And maybe clothing the naked. So I hear a lot of biblical story here. To clothe the naked. You're so right. Somebody said, we got to protect each man's dignity and guard each man's pride. And also each child. To clothe the naked. And then the courage to take the second step. Christianity is a religion of the second chance. Yeah, I blew it. And I confess I did. And now I'm in a new situation, and next time I'll be more prodigal in that situation. Well, this was fun doing this with you. Thank you very much, and have a good rest of the day.